Introduce our main speaker for this evening, David M. from San Diego.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Welcome. My name is David McGrevy. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to acknowledge the folks from 5107 and from Drunks Only who are here to support me tonight. Fabulous. And this is from Mark. You were great. Fabulous. And I have a question for you. What did the zero say to the eight?
I don't even know.
Nice belt. Thank you, Lori, for the opportunity to speak, and to the great team here who puts this on every week. You guys are fabulous. It says AA as such ought never be organized, so you guys are actually violating one of these traditions. In any event, I'm here tonight to tell you something about what happened, what it was like, well, actually, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My own agenda tonight is to deliver the message that there's room for everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you up front that I'm an agnostic, that I got sober on April 1st, 1988, and I'm still here. And I'm still here because of the black print, because of the verbs up there on the wall, because of the actions. But before I get to that, once upon a time, it's always good to see so many of you. That means I'm not the only one who could not afford a ticket to Paul McCartney. So I appreciate you giving that up to come here tonight. So once upon a time, long, long ago, in a faraway place, in Massachusetts, I was born. And at that time, I was very small and I was very young. As time went on, I grew larger. That's a trend that has continued. What I haven't done is grown up. And fortunately, I still have that head of me. I'm still seeking. I'm still asking. So as a child, I didn't like people. I still don't, actually. I stayed away from people. I stayed away from interaction. I was kind of a private, quiet kid. I spent a better part of one of my middle school years visiting the principal's office every day just to check in. It's not that I was hard. It was hard. It was hard to manage, I guess. It wasn't that I was antisocial. I just wasn't social. So I wouldn't participate in classes or follow teacher's instructions or anything like that. And that went through high school. In high school, I joined the camera club. And at that time, we had these really fabulous labs where we would develop film. And we would go into the lab, shut the door, put on the light that said we were developing film, and turn on the exhaust fan, and we'd smoke in there. It was a gift. That's one of the reasons I stayed. I did ultimately graduate. I think I was 285th out of 315 with a C-minus average. I had an agreement with my advisor. I didn't want to be there. He didn't want me there. So I left. A social studies teacher, nice guy, suggested I go to college because I was one of those kids, they said, didn't work up to his potential, whatever that means. And he arranged for me to go to an engineering school. I went. My father had been an engineer. That's the only thing I could think of. I had no sense of who I was or where I was going. So I went to this college, and it was an interesting experience because calculus was calculus, physics was calculus, chemistry was calculus, electrical engineering was calculus, and I was not a fan of calculus. But I did run for office. I became my class president. I got myself a little two-seater MGB3. Flunked out at the end of the first year. Worked at a place like Walmart for a while, decided that, and they wanted to keep me. They said, we've got a career for you here. And I looked around, I said, I don't think so. I went back to college, It was also during the time in which if you were not going to college, you were going to Vietnam. So I'm back to college, and I took a course in psychology, and I really liked it. I got in league with a bunch of so-called psych majors. They taught me how to be a student. They taught me how to study. And eventually I graduated, went on to graduate school. Nixon, you may not remember this guy, he did in the graduate deferments. I was invited to join the Army, I think, three times before I enlisted in the Air Force and ended up in the United States Air Force Human Resources Laboratory, where I spent time as an enlisted person developing assessment tests and job performance evaluations. I worked on the ASVAB, when it was brand new for those people who have ever taken that scale. While I was there, somehow I got asked to be an instructor for what was called the Alcohol Safety Action Project. It was the pilot program for what people lovingly know as SB38. Interestingly enough, my head was full of all of this stuff about alcohol and alcohol-related behaviors, in spite of the fact that one of the best times in my service career was Friday, when I could stop at the store and for 99 cents get a six-pack of Lone Star, good stuff, and for 99 cents would get a dozen tamales. I tended to be a binge drinker. I would not drink for several days at a time and then have at it. There was some indication that I had a special relationship with alcohol when the only gifts I received on my birthday or holidays would be scotch. My favorite gift was a bottle of Pinch. Some people may remember Hagen Pinch. It was a three-sided 12-year-old scotch. Good stuff. And so I was a scotch drinker until I wasn't. When I got out of the service, I returned to graduate school, completed a program. During this time, I had met a woman. We got married. We had twin daughters. And I went off to work at a college in northern New York, Potsdam, New York. We used to have T-shirts printed up there that said, "Potsdam is not at the end of the earth." And then small letters that said, "But you can see it from here." The closest store was a Ward's, and it was 70 miles away. There was nothing up there except for four colleges. And when the students left, there was very, very few people. The major industry there, of course, was drinking. Lots and lots and lots of bars. One of those bars, Alger's Pub, became my home. They wouldn't let anybody sit in my stool. I was special. I used to drink splits, 6-ounce beers, and when I had finished 23 in a case, I got the last one free. And I would do that frequently. That particular bar hosted a person by the name of Renee Fleming. When I was there, she was a student at Crane School of Music. She went on to have a career as an opera singer, and she would sing in this bar. In any event, it was during that time that I got my first DUI. It was my birthday. I stopped by to get my free beer and Jack Follower. And unfortunately, I drove too fast, the wrong place, and got invited by the Potsdam police to come back to the station, take a breathalyzer. When they found out who I was, they took me home. Those were the old days. During that time, this business of being restless, irritable, and discontent began to gnaw at me and my career and my marriage. I had placed work before everything. I worked and worked and worked and worked. I was the star in my department. I ignored the other 19 people in the department, trampled over them, climbed the stairway to success, stepping on their fingers all the way up. I got all of the bonuses, performance bonuses. They got none. I was the new kid. That didn't work really well. They found a way to invite me to leave After 5 years, and I took it. I went down the street to another school. And at this point, I was drinking every day. My marriage had gotten to the point where we decided to take a break. And my wife and children left Northern New York to go to Boston, which was a five-hour drive away. Without the constraints, everything went straight to hell. I was engaged in all kinds of behavior that I couldn't imagine I would ever have done, but I did it. Found myself in, we'll just say, compromising situations several times. My solution to the problem ultimately was to quit my job, sell my house and my furniture, and drive from the Canadian border and the Atlantic Ocean to the Mexican border and the Pacific Ocean. Some people call that doing a geographic. And so I drove across country, stopping every now and then to buy what was called a suitcase of Busch beer. Suitcases, 24-pack. And I figured out a way to continue to drive using the empty cans without having to stop for long, long periods of time. I was on my way to Alaska. I had heard that Alaska was the place to be, that they gave people money simply for living there, and that you could use that check at a bar. You could drink that check even before you got it. I said, that's heaven. That's where I'm going. But it was January, and the snow belt was relatively low at that time in the country. So I went south first and then came across 10. I got to San Diego to visit a friend. I got here. Flowers were blooming. This is January. People were surfing. Everybody was wearing shorts and sandals. Where am I? What's going on? I said, I'll check it out. I applied for a work. I got a job with a community college. I started writing grants, writing programs, still drinking now. I'd found another bar with my own stool. I should mention that when I stopped drinking, they raised the bar. It was a little bar next to El Indio. It was called Coco's. They knocked it down and replaced it with a fish restaurant, primarily because they couldn't rely on my income. In any event, one night with a lower companion, we got into a snit, and I took this brand new dollar. I could get a 16-ounce draft there for a dollar. Maybe I'm dating myself. And I was in the process of throwing it at her, for whatever reason, when this person, maybe 6'6 and 300 pounds, who was a shift manager at the Intercontinental, he was the security guy, got between us, and he got all of the beer on him. And he walked me outside, interestingly enough, because he was good at that. He walked me outside the bar, and my car was parked in front, of course. It was my spot. It was my bar. And I got in the car and started it up, and then the inside of the car turned blue. It turns out there was a police car right behind me. I had not seen it. They had watched the entire event. And that led to a 20-minute drive around town, handcuffed with a full bladder, waiting to get to the drunk tank, which was downtown at the time. And they put me in a special cell. They didn't want me to come in contact with other people. And they let me lie down in there. I got a phone call. I called the owner of the bar, who posted bail for me. That's building a relationship. That led to a series of events. A visit to traffic court. The public defender, probably because I had gotten drunk the night before and smelled like a brewery, wasn't very helpful. It was a banner year. They had changed the penalties, and there was a fine and 5 years probation and 3 days as an outpatient at Descanso. If you don't know what Descanso is, it's a prison. So I got to go there for 3 days and work in addition to the fine and everything else. And I had to do 30 AA meetings. I put it off for as long as I could. I had a deadline. I think it was April 30th. And when I was completely out of options, and I picked a date. So my sobriety date is April 1st, 1988. That was April Fool's Day, Good Friday. I picked it. Something about my ego. Because it was off to the cross. My life was going to end. And in a very real way, thank God it did. Because it did. And a new one started. In the process of meeting my the court-ordered requirements, I called downtown, AA Central's downtown, and I asked for a meeting where they wore suits, because I wore a suit. And I certainly wasn't going to go to a meeting where there were people like you. So they told me, go to Drunks Only. And at that time, it was about a dozen guys, because they had driven all the women away. And we won't elaborate on that, but that's true. And they wore suits. And they drove Porsches and Cadillacs. And I looked around and I said, I want what they have. I did. And I picked out a guy who was a lawyer, which is funny because I hate lawyers. But I picked, except for you. And any other prosecuting. Okay. And because he wore a three-piece suit and drove a Porsche, I said, this is the guy I want to be with. And fortunately, he and his crew there at Drunks Only put me under their wing. They at that time, it met 5 days a week. It now meets 7 days a week. They hustled me off to a 24-hour diner after every meeting. They had a reserved corner booth at this 24-hour place. And they would slide me in the middle and come in on both sides so I couldn't get out. And they'd ask me how my day was going. And I would tell them about all of the things that were happening to me and that no one was listening. And they weren't either, because they kept saying to me, well, what's your part in it? 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 You know, they never figured out who I was. And they dragged me off to a step study. And I don't think it was in, may have been in Lemon Grove. It's moved. But I went to this step study and went through and listened to it with primarily men share on the 12 steps again and again and again and again. Because I am a slow learner when it comes to stuff I haven't approved. And I hadn't approved of any of these things. So that same step study also did the 12 traditions, and again and again and again and again. And it's because of my sponsor in that group who said, read the black print and look at, I call them, the verbs, that this is a program of action. There's even a chapter called Into Action in the first 164 pages of the big book. I'll point out, like one of the persons who tells one of the stories, there is no chapter on into thinking. There is no chapter on into feeling. There's a chapter on into action. And because those guys were so insistent on paying attention to what I did and not to what I was thinking or not to what I was feeling, I got to stay here. And that has been a real struggle for me. Let me recount one thing that happened in my teen years. I can't pick the exact age, but I had already had a driver's license. My father was an excommunicated Catholic. My mother was a something, something, whatever. And neither one of them were particularly religious or churchgoers, and they had dumped my brother and I at the Baptist church and sped away. And so I participated in activities there because there were girls there, and I had a driver's license. Perfect. And it was ideal. But they had other ideas. They invited me to be give a sermon for Youth Day or whatever. And so I wrote something up, delivered it, and it was very well received. In fact, I learned after the fact, they went behind my back, talked to my parents, my cousins, trying to get me to go to the seminary in Hartford. And I didn't believe a thing I wrote or said. I knew from that moment on that it was all a sham. That changed everything. I never appreciated, it's hard to find the right words, organized religion after that, of any sort. And when I threw the bathwater out, so went the baby. And the idea that there was this omnipotent, all-caring designer and guider, no, didn't go. But I worked my butt off trying to make that reasonable. But the guys that I'd gotten sober with were kind of traditional. It didn't bother them that Alcoholics Anonymous is a thinly veiled Christian program. Bothered me a lot. But I stuck because of the verbs, because the focus was on what I did and not what I thought or what I felt. And I stayed with them, and we did retreats together. And I participated. I read all kinds of organized religion texts and books, and got tied up with one particular church, and dumped in thousands and thousands of dollars, and became a class teacher and a participant on one of their organized programs of instruction, and a board member, and nothing clicked. And after years and years, I have had to recognize that I am an agnostic. And I am sober here today because of the actions I have taken. I'll come back to some other details. But I finally joined Alcoholics Anonymous last October in my 31st year. And that happened with the publication of this grapevine thing called One Big Tent. And in this publication, there are 42 stories from atheists and agnostics who have gotten sober and stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. At the same time, a document that was first published in the United Kingdom called The God Word also became available to us. And in here, there are 10 stories from atheists and agnostics who got sober and stayed sober. I had an opportunity to share at the long-timers meeting at the Spring Roundup, and I used my 3 minutes to point these publications out. And afterward, I had people coming up to me, one person in tears, thanking me for sharing that with them. I had another person come up and said, you be sure to tell these people, whoever they may be, that I have 50 years and I'm an atheist. And another person who had over 60 years as an agnostic. And I was uncomfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous for 30 years, trying to fit in, trying to find a place. And I'm still here because of, well, let's see. Admitted, came to believe, made a decision, made an inventory, admitted, was ready, asked, made a list, made amends. I'm here today because I did things I didn't want to do. I didn't do any of those things before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't spontaneously do any of those things. And when I first saw those things, I was extraordinarily uninterested in participating. And again, it's the kindness of the men that were here who had room for me and allowed me to be who I was. Now, I will have to say that there's some, the word would be condescending. A pat on the head you'll get it. Because there wasn't an explicit recognition at that time, like there is today, that there's always have been atheists and agnostics in Alcoholics Anonymous. AA number four, Jim Burwell, the author of the As We Understand Him. And by the way, his story is right in the beginning of this book. I want to read about Jim Burwell and his story. So today I'm very much at home in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I see my function, my work now, is to make it possible for those people who have been quiet for however long they've been in the rooms and not felt like they had a home. Well, I'm here to tell you got a home, that it works. And it works if you do it. How many times have you heard that? And as I go through the big book, I pay attention to the phrase, relief from the bondage of self. It turns out that for me, these actions relieve me of my worst nightmare. David is his name. And when I give David the reins to my life, and I'm supposed to use the F word, I know that. I'm F'd, right? That's the deal. But when I do these actions and I'm able to get out from under David, I discovered that there is a force other than myself. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my job wasn't to find a power greater than myself. It was to find a power other than myself. I am stuck with the constraints of me and a brain disorder that I know as alcohol use disorder, that we call alcoholism, that comes with symptoms which include the inability to assume the perspective of another person. When I hear the word selfish and self-centered, I don't listen to selfish. If you cannot assume the perspective of another, you have to assume that the world is just exactly the way you have contrived it. And you're always wondering why it is people don't live according to your world. And until you're able to take the perspective of another person, you don't get it. You're not being selfish because you're who you are. One of the symptoms of alcohol use disorder is that inability to assume the perspective of another person. All of the stuff that we're asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous runs in head on. Get into service. Stick your hand out. We say it 1,000 different ways. And we discover that when we're busy serving someone else and not serving ourselves, there's this huge sense of relief. This huge sense of release. I should point out I'm not very good at that. And it's a constant struggle for me because I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I know that's newcomers, I hope hear something tonight that will allow you to come back. That's a tough nut, that's a bitter pill to realize that you are bodily. You've probably figured that out because you got here to AA. But the hard part is mentally different from your fellows. There's a part of you that is going to take you back to where you're most comfortable. Numb, probably. And that's difficult to deal with. I was instructed beforehand to tell the truth and use small words. I find that difficult. I'm educated beyond my intelligence. That was supposed to be funny. I'll just say this once. I'm a cognitive scientist. And so when I make these remarks about how our brains function or don't function, it comes from a data-based understanding of how humans function. I can't escape me, the scientist. And it makes perfect sense to me when I understand my own limitations. I could not have come to know those limitations without you guys, without my sponsor, without that initial group of men's, without being in your presence day after day after day because I have to. You know, I never know why I'm going to a meeting until I get there. And it's like, ah, that's it. Usually sometimes between 35 and 45 minutes into a meeting, the fog clears. And I figure out why I'm there again. And that David is still here. But the behavior isn't. The thinking is still there. Someone once said early on in my sobriety that you may not be responsible for your first thought because you're an alcoholic, but you are responsible for your second thought. And I didn't have any second thoughts until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and people provided me with second thoughts. I do not have to act on every feeling I have, every thought I have. That's news for me. It was easier the other way. It's harder trying to pay attention to you. I don't even know why I should do that. But if I pay attention to you, I make a connection outside myself. I get out of myself. I discover what I call not David. So is there a power other than me? Absolutely. I call it not David. That's it. That's all I know. I'm sober today. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous today because of a power other than myself, a power greater than myself. And there's a sentence in the second appendix of the big book that the essence of a spiritual experience is the recognition of a power greater than yourself. And I'm comfortable with that today. Let's see, because that's the message I want to deliver. If you have some questions about the G word, as I like to call it, if you have some uncertainty, then there's some material you can look at today. If you're a sponsor and you're working with people who are having a difficult time with the G word, then there's material you can read. You yourself may be able to take a perspective, a new perspective, and the person you're working with may feel a sense of comfort knowing that they're not alone. That was the tough part of 30 years not fitting in. Every now and then I would find somebody who shared my point of view. Rarely were we vocal about it. I have tended to be vocal about it in my home group because I feel safe there. That's drunks only, and they have allowed me to be sober, act sober, and say what I need to say from my particular point of view. Early on, the group of men suggested to me that I should probably avoid relationships other than transitory ones. They didn't care if I went out and found someone to engage in corporal activities. What they did care is if I developed an attachment to somebody with the thought that that might interfere with the process of becoming sober. I had met this person, and I went to my sponsor, and I discussed this person, and he asked me, "What are your motives? What's your motivation?" This particular group of men always asks that. You know, it really ruins a lot of stuff if you've got to stop and examine yourself. All I want to do is get laid. It really ruins a lot of stuff, in any event. And we talked about it at length, and he said, "Go ahead." And I developed this relationship. This woman and I were together for almost 5 years. She gave me my first four cakes, I think. We lived a life together. I had, at this time, being divorced and being away from my children, reintroduced my children to myself in a relationship. And then she became sick. She had a very virulent form of cancer and died. Why do I mention this? The men that I was with in AA brought meetings to the room in Strip Screens Hospital for me, because I was essentially living in her room. Wow. The support of the people in this program is amazing. And it doesn't have to be explicit. I look at somebody, somebody looks at me, and there's a kind of understanding that comes. And many of these men had been through what I went through, and that loss devastated me and destroyed me. The person who I was lost forever. And I think anybody that's had a loss experience like that recognizes that it is a life-changing, life-altering event. It can also be another tool in your toolkit. You can now be of service to others where you couldn't have been service before. But I was back into restless, irritable, and discontent. I was in a period of tailspin again. I doubled down at work. I doubled down at that church that I had been trying to fit into. And then after a period of time, I met another person at this church. And she ambushed me. And we've been dating for the last 25 years. Between us, we have 8 children and 12 or 14 grandchildren, something like that. And the kids are all over the planet. I have daughters who live in Scotland and New Zealand. She has kids that live in California and Washington, D.C. I don't care what weekend it is, there's always somebody's birthday. Always something going on. So today, I was at an Irish dancing festival where 2 of the grandkids were performing. There's always something going on. I get to stay in touch with my daughters with whom I have an adult relationship. My babies are going to be 44 this summer. A productive adult relationship. And during the time where all of this good stuff is happening, my brother passed away quickly from a virulent form of cancer. The people in these rooms were, again, there for me. My mother passed away. I got the call in the middle of a drunks-only meeting. I didn't take the call. I saw the area code in Massachusetts, and so I knew it wasn't going to be good. And when I listened to the message, she was gone. And again, the people were here who'd been through this before had shown me what to do, how to act. You know, there's a lot of fancy words we throw around in here. Honesty, openness, willingness. This is the only place I've ever been able to see it. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to see honesty. I get to see openness. I get to see willingness. You show me through your actions what these words mean. Nowhere else in my life have I been able to find that, even in places where supposedly those resources are there. I didn't find them. I found them here. I am in a continual state of learning. Somebody once called me a seeker, because somewhere in the book it says something about seeking, not finding, but seeking. And I am still seeking. I'm still wondering. I'm still fascinated by this thing that I don't know anything about, the thing I call not David. I don't dimensionalize it. I don't try to label it. I don't try to name it. But I'm not responsible for my sobriety. I'm not responsible for doing any of those things. I had to be shown. And because I get them, because I did them, I get to stand here today. And I'm looking forward to, working on the spring roundup. If you're looking for a way to become involved in Alcoholics Anonymous that takes you beyond your own group, then sign up just for the amusement of serving on one of the committees that put together the San Diego Spring Roundup every year. There's 34 or 35 committees. You've never seen, well, unless you've been a GSR and you've seen what it's like. But if you haven't been a GSR, it's amazing to see how difficult it is to herd 33 cats. And yet, and for newcomers, put this on your list. Go to the Spring Roundup next April. And see what it's like to hang out with 2,400 people who are still partying, but they're sober. Still, yeah, we don't quit partying. No. We just do it differently. So you should do that. You should get involved. And you'll learn something about this program. I've had a chance to hang around a bit, so I've learned about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts. Is that right? Is that what they are? Bill, our used car salesman founder, was a numerologist. He liked 12s. When he modified the Oxford Group 6 steps, he came up with only 11. And that was unacceptable, so he split one. And the one he split is 6 and 7 to make it 12. You learn that this is an organization that is quite complex. We have quite an organization within the county, within the state, within the country, across the world. I've been at meetings in Oman in the Middle East, where one of my daughters lived for 16 years, with a whole bunch of expats. And it's the same meeting. It's the same materials. I went to a meeting in Scotland. Those people drove me crazy. It was a people like, you know, the old retired people that just go to AA. Like me? Because I got to retire from a 40-plus year career in college teaching only a year ago. These folks in Glasgow, I learned how to pronounce it, Scotland, I went to the meeting. Want a cup of tea? Oh, no, I'm good. Second. Want a cup of tea? Oh, no, no. Third. Want a cup of tea? 10 times. Yes, give me the tea. Wherever one goes, you find friendly, not everybody, right? You find a lot of friendly sober material. For your newcomers, if you like everyone you meet in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you very much.